16. Fragments. They have come great distances to destroy the world. They have come from other worlds, obscure systems, from far-off stars and remoter star clusters. They have come from every corner of what was, for one fleeting and glorious moment, the Imperium of Man. And beyond. They have come from other spaces, other realms, other layers of creation and other flavors of reality. They have come from the roiling psycho-ocean of the warp. They have come from hell. Baleful eyes blink at the light of a new world. Baleful eyes in pugnacious horror faces. The black fur around the glittering eyes is still matted with thawing interstellar ice. They have come a long way to be here. Helig Galor kills the last of some traitor Exertus on the walkway behind Seidel House. Once of the Death Guard's 7th Great Company, now Knight Errant, Galor's loyalty is uninterrupted. He looks at the bodies littering the flowerbeds around him. The fools thought they could ambush him. They should have brought more than 30. If they'd wanted a fair fight, though nothing has been fair for a very long time. Galor recognizes the insignia on the blood-soaked tunics. Maruddin 18th Assault Carder, or at least that's what they had been once. Merud, he thinks. That's a long way out, beyond Psychex. These men had come a long way to be here. They'd come a long way just to die. They've come a long way. The last leg has been a slow, exhausting trek up through the compressed grave cities and ancient stratigraphy of past civilizations on which the palace was built. They've seen sights, marvels, astonishing relics, over which, if he'd had a mind to, old Pearson might have lingered. But he hasn't. Time's against them. And the crushed layers of compacted cities seem too much like a précis of his life, which has been long, longer than John's, longer even than his, longer than anyone's. Ol doesn't wish to linger and remember. He wants to get there. He's embarked on the longest and most uncanny odyssey that anyone has ever undertaken, and he wants it done with. Besides, there's something following them. It's been chasing them since they set out from Kalth, something in the darkness that's getting closer by the hour. He can feel it in his old bones, and in the knife that shivers in his hand. He was a farmer when he set out, but that life of crops and toil and peace was just a brief interval. His favourite interval, it had to be said. The best of all the short stories that make up his history. But it was just a tiny island in the vast archipelago of his experience. He's been many things, as many things as there are to be. Soldier, scholar, husband, coward, pacifist, parent, navigator, ruler, friend. He was even War Master once, the first ever to bear that title. Most of all, more than anything, he's been a voyager, a sailor, a seafarer, a traveller, a wanderer. He's known the infinite wonders of a voyaging life and understands that the sweetest part of any journey is always the ending. Land in sight at last, breakers on the beach, the sloping light of evening marking the rooftops of a longed-for home. The end of this voyage will not be sweet. He only hopes it will be worthwhile. This voyage, his last, he is sure, has been the strangest and greatest of all. So strange, so perilous, that it would have been rejected by myth-weavers as too fanciful. He stepped between stars, across galaxies. He sliced holes in the curtain of the Immaterium with his athame and slipped through them, from place to time and time to place, against the linear weft of history and the reassuring logic of material reality, a circuitous route beset by danger, pursued every step of the way to get here. Home. Terra. The last and furthest shore. The sloping light of evening on familiar rooftops. His birthplace, and the place where everything began. The place where, one way or another, everything will end. Ols brought others with him, unwillingly, though to leave them behind would have consigned them to death. Even so, one has fallen already. Ol worries how many of them will survive the last stretch. He's offered them chances to stop along the way, to stay behind in safe ports while he goes on alone, but they've refused. They're in this now, confused, committed, utterly loyal to him in ways he can't credit. John, his friend, his nemesis, calls them the Argonauts. To Ol, that's a slight on both the prowess of the original crew to bear that name and to the bravery of this company. He has, after all, known both. They walk with him, his long companions, up through the cavern track. Cat, the latent psyker, close at his side, simmering with unease. Dogent Crank, the steady and stubborn soldier. Hebert Zibes, the simple farmhand to whom everything is miraculous and thus nothing startling. And Graft, the battered cultivation servitor, which has trundled far outside the remit of its task programming. They've acquired fellow travellers along the way. Leetu, or more properly, LE2, Erda's bodyguard, loaned to John for the duration. In unpainted silver plate, as stoic and unyielding as his demeanour, Leetu is a space marine. Ol believes he's a prototype of the Astartes breed, perhaps even an early test, his genetic profile unmodified by any Primarch seed. His beaked helm, armour pattern and bolt weapon speak of a time when the first batches were made and the replacement of the Thunder Warriors began. Ol wishes he'd been there with John to speak to Erda and quiz her about Leetu. Has she always had him? Did she keep him back when the first samples were cast in the Sigilite's progenoid labs? Is he a stolen treasure, a memento, or was he made for her as a gift? So many puzzles, and they're not even the start. More than anything, Ol wishes he'd simply been able to meet Erda again, to talk of things directly, to construct a plan, to recall the histories they once shared and the man they both knew. But the rendezvous proved impossible. Something, an imprecise cut with the Athame, perhaps, or the sabotaging efforts of those set against them, or just the ever-increasing warp saturation around their destination world, threw them off course, like a sudden storm in the Cyclades, and cast them up on a desolate shore in the wrong time and the wrong place. They only survived that misadventure because John, God bless his determination, found them, and, with Leetu at his side, pulled them from danger. Ol's missed the chance to meet with Erda and consult a soul, the Mater Omnium, who's considerably wiser and better informed than he is. They could have made a plan, for, truth of it is, he has none at all, except to stop this, by any means necessary. That's it, the top and bottom of it. Ol will have to improvise when the time comes, just as he did with Polyphemus and that awkward time in Yargrain's chambers. Worst of all, Ol fears that whatever's following them will have traced a path to Erda and discovered her after her centuries of careful self-exile. If that's true, if she's been harmed. Then there's the Alpharius. Utterly untrustworthy, yet utterly essential. Only he knows the last steps of the way. So Ol must countenance his presence, even though he has a poor history with Hydras. The teeth of the dragon have never been sown in his favour. Ol knows the Alpharius is vital because Acte has told him so. She's their other new companion, the blind prophetess in tattered red, a creature of immense, perhaps deathless, power, who conjures from his memory the witch queens of the ancient Aegean and Colchis at their nightmarish best and beautiful worst. Like John, Acte's life has been threaded through the tapestry of this war, used and spurned by both sides. She stands with them now, of her own volition, and according to her own agenda. Or so she says. Acte and Alpharius. Without them, they can go no further nor hope to prevail. But with them, the question becomes, further into what? What unifies the band is a desire for salvation. All's far from convinced that Acte's vision of salvation resembles his in any way at all. Cat despises her. In part, that's the friction of two active minds in close proximity, jarring and sparking against each other. But All knows that Cat can see more than she is able to say. As they walk, Cat glances at him from time to time, warning looks that ask, "Why do you let her come with us?" She's too afraid to explain her fears to All. Finally, John, of course. John Grammaticus, pawn of the Xenos Cabal, an artificial perpetual employed to agitate the war and escalate it to a pitch that would end in Horus's victory and the subsequent annihilation of the human race. This, the Cabal dreamed, would be a means to snuff out the ruinous threat of chaos. But that genocidal scheme is abandoned, forsaken by the Cabal when they realized that Horus's power was beyond even their ingenious manipulation. All knows that John, forever the cat's paw, now wishes to make amends and break the deadlock of the war. He's taken ownership of his last ration of mortality and intends to use it well. John's the reason All is on this odyssey. John believes All's deep history with the thing now known as the Emperor can exert an influence and change the course of damnation. All's not so sure. Nothing and no one has ever changed the Emperor's mind or persuaded him to reconsider his plans. But there's a chance. A minuscule one, worth all this risk. A chance to stop the Emperor leading mankind to what All always warned would be the inescapable consequence of his ambitions. Not glory, not the ascension of the human race, just the dark and hopeless bonfire of the triumph of ruin. The knife shivers in his hand. The lapped stone thing is old, Neolithic old. It's played its part in history. The instrument of the original murder, splashed with the blood of Abel, the executioner of Gog. It's lain on the painted top of a great round table and passed from demon to man and back again. All took it from the word-bearers, who had come to understand the potency of such objects and had taken to collecting them. A blade like it, similarly cursed by fate, initiated this cataclysm. Perhaps, as a mirroring ritual, the Athame can end it. Perhaps. The Athame's just stone, just old stone, but its past has created a resonance in the immaterium, the staining shadow of murder. It's tired of cutting time and space. It has killed 7 times. It's been promised an 8th death. If that's what it takes, All will do it if he has to. Plunging that blade into... It wouldn't be the first time.
"Your thoughts are fascinating," says Acte.
"Get out of them, please," says All.
"I can't read them, Alanius. You mask them well, but I can taste them. They taste intriguing, as though they are, well, unthinkable." "He said get out of his head, so get out of it," says Cat.
Acte pauses and turns her head to consider Cat, as if she's looking at her, though her blind eyes are wrapped.
"Then should I peer into you instead?"
she inquires.
Your mind is odd, girl. There is so little of you, as if everything has been wrapped up and put away out of sight. Did you decide to forget who you used to be? Or was there nothing to remember in the first place?
There's a smack, like a hand striking flesh. Acte's head jerks sideways slightly. When she turns back, she touches the smile her mouth has become.
Nice shot, she says. Bear in mind that's the only one you'll get. Only one I'll need, says Cat. If it teaches you to keep your mind to yourself.
That's enough, says Ol, stepping between them. He's too tired for this nonsense. Everyone is looking. Zybes, Crank, even Graft. We go together, or we go our separate ways, says Ol.
Here,
says Acte, gesturing to the deep cleft around them with her long, expressive fingers and longer nails.
Part company down here, Alanis.
The track is steep, uneven and narrow. The rock floor glitters with threads of minerals. Gloom gathers breathlessly. The walls lean in over their heads. It's like an axe wound split into the rock. I found my way out of other labyrinths, he tells her. Play nice. Don't pry. Acte nods, a surprisingly courteous gesture.
Of course. I'm just incurably inquisitive, and I am fascinated by the company I find myself in.
That was your choice, says Ol.
It was. I apologize, Cat,
says Acte. Ol looks at Cat. Her fists are bald, her cheeks flushed, her eyes drawn narrow. She glares at Acte. Cat's life has been miserable. Ol knows that. An unregistered psyker, Cat's spent her years hiding, or being shunned, or both. She's leery of everything, especially uninvited questions. Ol's little band is the first and only place she has found a purpose. She came to him as a survivor, a refugee seeking rescue. But she's the only one he really trusts. Because there's no side to her, no agenda, just tough, honest loyalty. He trusts her more than John. He trusts everyone more than Acte, even the damn Alpha. Leetu appears behind them. Their lamplight catches on the silvered unfinish of his plate. He seems as fresh as he did when they set out on this long, slow climb hours earlier. His hand is to the ear guard of his helm.
Message, he says, from Alpharius. He requests we stay here. He's securing an area ahead. Him and Grammaticus.
Securing? Asks Crank.
He didn't explain, replies Leetu. If I ask, I won't get a straight answer. This part of the journey is his call.
He looks at Acte.
Correct?
Yes,
says Acte.
Let's wait here, then, says Ol. Rest.
He finds a low rock, settles his weight against it, eases his aching feet. Zybes unstoppers a flask of water and takes a sip. Acte folds her great height onto the ground and sits cross-legged, as if she's taking a stance on a meditation mat in some ashram. She places her wrists on her knees, palms up.
So,
she says,
what shall we talk about?